ladies and gentlemen. I am guilty this evening of the presumption and aware of the responsibility of reversing a rule of scientific method by which we arrive at the less familiar through previous knowledge of that which is better known. I should feel more comfortable, and I think you would acknowledge a greater propriety, if on this occasion the third lecturer on the Gideon Seymour Memorial Foundation were telling you who I am. It is my privilege to introduce our speaker to what must surely be the largest audience ever assembled to hear a discourse on literary criticism. I have the honor to present to you an old friend whom I would acknowledge as my master, the most eminent man of letters in the world, the greatest living poet, and if I may alter a phrase of one of his masters, Maestro di Color che Scrivono, I present to you Mr. T.S. Eliot.
Ladies and gentlemen, after this eloquent, brief, but I think I may say hyperbolical introduction, I feel that my own lecture will be something of an anticlimax and very dry. But I ask you to remember that I have never before in my life seen so many people at one time. All facing in my direction. For the moment, at least. I hope you will be charitable to my inexperience as a speaker in circumstances like this, and I also hope that by the time I have finished, I shall find a considerable number of you still here. Now, to come to the dryness. The thesis of this paper is that there are limits exceeding which, in one direction, literary criticism ceases to be literary. The term, the new criticism, is often employed by people without realizing what a variety it comprehends. But its currency does not, I think, recognize the fact that the more distinguished critics of today, however widely they differ from each other, all differ in some significant way from the critics of a generation ago. Many years ago, I pointed out that every generation must provide its own literary criticism. For, as I said, each generation brings to the contemplation of art its own categories of appreciation, makes its own demands upon art, and has its own uses for art. When I made this statement, I'm sure that I had in mind a good deal more than mere changes of taste and fashion. I had in mind at least the fact that each generation, looking at masterpieces of the past in a different perspective, is affected in its attitude by a greater number of influences than those which bore upon the generation previous. But I doubt whether I had in mind the fact that an important work of literary criticism can alter and expand the content of the term literary criticism itself. If we could follow the evolution of the term literary criticism in the same way, we would find something similar happening. Compare a critical masterpiece like Johnson's Lives of the Poets with the next great critical work to follow it, Coleridge's Biographia Literaria. It's not merely that Johnson represents a literary tradition to the end of which he himself belongs, while Coleridge is defending the merits and criticizing the weaknesses of a new style. The difference more pertinent to what I've been saying is due to the scope and variety of the interests which Coleridge brought to bear on his discussion of poetry. He established the relevance of philosophy, aesthetics, and psychology. And once Coleridge had introduced these disciplines into literary criticism, future critics could ignore them only at their own risk. I was struck not long ago by an observation of Mr. Aldous Huxley in a preface to the English translation of The Supreme Wisdom, a book by a French psychiatrist, Dr. Hubert Benoit, on the psychology of Zen Buddhism. Mr. Huxley's observation responded to the impression which I had myself received from that remarkable book when I read it in the original. Huxley is comparing Western psychiatry with the discipline of the East as found in Tao and Zen. The aim of Western psychiatry, says Mr. Huxley, is to help the troubled individual to adjust himself to the society of less troubled individuals. Individuals who are observed to be well adjusted to one another and to the local institutions, but about whose adjustment to the fundamental order of things no inquiry is made. But there is another kind of normality, a normality of perfect functioning. Even a man who is perfectly adjusted to a deranged society can prepare himself, if he so desires, to become adjusted to the nature of things. So far, Aldous Huxley. The applicability of this to my present matter is not immediately obvious. But just as Western psychiatry, from the Zen Buddhist point of view, is confused or mistaken as to what healing is for, and its attitude needs really to be reversed, so I wonder whether the weakness of modern criticism is not an uncertainty as to what criticism is for, an uncertainty as to what benefit it is to bring and to whom. Its very richness and variety have perhaps obscured its ultimate purpose. Every critic may have his eye on a definite goal, may be engaged on a task which needs no justification, and yet criticism itself may be lost as to its aims. I have been somewhat bewildered to find from time to time that I am regarded as one of the ancestors of modern criticism, if too old to be a modern critic myself. Thus, in a book which I read recently by an author who is undoubtedly a modern critic, I find a reference to the new criticism, by which, he says, I mean not only the American critics, but the whole critical movement that derives from T.S. Eliot. I didn't understand why the author should isolate me so sharply from the American critics. But on the other hand, I fail to see any critical movement which can be said to derive from myself. The best of my literary criticism, then, apart from a few notorious phrases which have had a truly embarrassing success in the world, consists of essays on poets and poetic dramatists who had influenced me. It is a byproduct of my private poetry workshop, or a prolongation of the thinking that went into the formation of my own verse. In retrospect, I see that I wrote best about poets whose work had influenced my own, and with whose poetry I had become thoroughly familiar long before I desired to write about them, or had found any occasion to do so. You planted last year in your garden? This sounds like raving, unless you recognize the allusions. It is merely an earnest seeker trying to establish some connection between the wasteland and Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, bliss of having led critics into temptation. The notes to the wasteland. I must explain how that came about. I had at first intended only to put down all the references for my quotations, with a view to spiking the guns of critics of my earlier poems who had accused me of plagiarism. Then, when it came to print The Wasteland as a little book, for the poem on its first appearance in the Dial and in the Criterion had no notes whatever, it was discovered that the poem was inconveniently short. So I set to work to expand the notes in order to provide a few more pages of printed matter. With the result that they became the remarkable exposition of bogus scholarship that is still on view today. I've sometimes thought of getting rid of these notes, but now they never can be unstuck. They've had almost a greater popularity than the poem itself. Anyone who bought my book of poems and found that the notes to The Wasteland were not in it would demand his money back, I'm sure. But I don't think these notes did any harm to other poets. Certainly, I can't think of any good contemporary poet who has abused this same practice. As for Miss Marianne Moore, her notes to poems are always pertinent, curious, conclusive, delightful, and give no encouragement to the researcher of origins. No, it's not because somehow got into the drawing room. But the analysis of Prufrock was not an attempt to find origins, either in literature or in the darker recesses of my own private life. It was an attempt to find out what the poem really meant, whether that was what I had meant it to mean or not. And for that, I was grateful. There were several essays which struck me as good. But as every method has its own limitations and dangers, it's only reasonable to mention what seemed to me the limitations and dangers of this one. Dangers which, if it were practiced for what I suspect should be its chief use, that is, as an exercise for students of English literature, it would be the business of the teacher to warn his class against. The first danger is that of assuming that there must be just one interpretation of the poem as a whole, which is right. There will be always, of course, details of explanation, especially with poems written in another age than ours, matters of fact, historical allusions, the meaning of a certain word at a certain date, which can be established, and the teacher can see that his pupils get these right. But as for the meaning of the poem as a whole, it is not exhausted by any explanation, for the meaning is what the poem means to different sensitive readers. The second danger, a danger in which I don't think the critics in this volume have fallen, but it's a danger to which the reader is exposed, is that of assuming that the interpretation of a poem, if valid, is necessarily an account of what the author, consciously or unconsciously, was trying to do. For the tendency is so general to believe that we understand the poem when we have identified its origins and traced the process to which the poet submitted his materials, that we may easily believe the converse, that any explanation of the poem is also an account of how it was written. The analysis of Prufrock, to which I have referred, interested me because it helped me to see the poem through the eyes of an intelligent, sensitive, and diligent reader. That is not at all the same thing as saying that he saw the poem through my eyes, or that his account has anything to do with the experiences that led up to my writing it, or to anything I experienced in the process of writing it. And my third comment is that I should, as a test, like to see this method applied to some new and very good poem previously unknown to me, because I should like to find out whether, after perusing the analysis, I should ever be able to enjoy the poem. For nearly all the poems in this volume were poems that I had known and loved for many years. And after reading the analyses, I found I was slow to recover my previous feelings about the poems. It was very much as if someone had taken the machine to pieces and left me with the task of reassembling the parts. I suspect, indeed, that a good deal of the value of an interpretation is that it should be my own interpretation, or your own interpretation. There are many things, perhaps, to know about this poem or that, many facts about which scholars can instruct me, which will help me to avoid definite misunderstanding. But a valid interpretation, I believe, must be at the same time an interpretation of my own feelings when I read it. It's been no part of my purpose to give a comprehensive view of all the types of literary criticism practiced in our time. For here, and in a great deal of other poetry, I see nothing to be explained. Nothing, that is, that would help me. What matters most, let us say, in reading an ode of Sappho, is not that I should imagine myself to be an island Greek of 2,500 years ago. What matters is that experience which is the same for all human beings capable of enjoying poetry of different centuries and languages, the spark which can leap across those 2,500 years. So the critic to whom I am most grateful is the one who can make me look at something I have never looked at before, or looked at only with eyes clouded by prejudice, set me face to face with it, and then leave me alone with it. From that point, I must rely upon my own sensibility, intelligence, and capacity for wisdom. If in literary criticism we place all the emphasis on understanding, we're in danger of slipping from understanding to mere explanation. We're in danger even of pursuing criticism as if it was a science, which it never can be. If, on the other hand, we overemphasize enjoyment, we will tend to fall into the subjective and impressionistic, and our enjoyment will profit us no more than mere amusement and pastime. 33 years ago, it seems to have been the latter type of criticism, the impressionistic, that had caused the annoyance expressed in my writing on the function of criticism. Today, it seems to me that we need to be more on guard against the purely explanatory. But I don't want to leave you with the impression that I wish to condemn the criticism of our time. These last 30 years have been, I think, a brilliant period in literary criticism, both in England and in America. It may even come to seem, in retrospect, to have been too brilliant. Who knows?
Well, you started at the beginning, yeah.
What?
Started at the beginning, but, you know.
Oh, you want to go on?
Oh.
Is it ready to go?
Uh-huh.
Well, this was at near Madison, Minnesota, but it's across the Dakota line. It's actually in Dakota, where at one of the farm sales, the holiday sales, there was the sheriff and his lifetime friend were both men of about, in their late 50s, and both way overweight, probably 250 up. And when they organized, the sheriff was trying to keep the sale from going through under the holiday setup. And his friend, he was, of course, a strong holiday member, see, and they got into quite an argument. And the sheriff had his deputies all there, already there, and he had charge of his deputies, see, and the argument got so hot between the sheriff and his friend, and finally his friend grabbed up a pitchfork and took after the sheriff with a pitchfork, see. And they would run about 100 yards, and they would stand there and pant like dogs and chasing a rabbit, you know, in the summertime. And then they'd catch their breath and they'd start out again. The last we seen them, they were going up over a little hill about a half mile away. And of course the deputies then were just disorganized and had nobody to direct them, and that was the end of the resistance there. That's the way that caved in. And there was a incident of a railroad conductor on the Milwaukee Road. That is when I was in the bookstore over on Marquette Avenue. He came in there and he started, just cursing me up one side and down the other because I was all to blame for selling his youngest son radical literature. Although I didn't even know his son at that time. And I tried to explain to the old man, but there was no use trying to talk to him. He was just so anti-communist, you know. See, that was all, anything progressive was communism to him. Well, it went on for a week or two, and then he come in again. And just had to put a stop to it. Now his second son, younger son, had been contaminated, see. And, about that time, I was busy and had about enough of it. And I said to him, you damned old bastard. I said, you're supposed to be a union man. I said, why ain't you out there on the picket line at the Ornamental Ironworks? I said, well, there's a real union fight going on. I said, that's where you should be. You should be helping those pickets. Instead of down here, I said, talking about communism. Well, I didn't see the old man anymore for about 3 weeks. And he come in, head all bandaged up. Say, he says, you know, he says, you're right. He says, it isn't the communists that start the violence. It's the damn police, he says. Look at my head. I was sitting on the running board, he said, rubbing my feet after walking on that picket line for 2 hours. My feet hurt like hell, he said. And he says, the first thing I know, here come a couple of police around the car. He says, no, whang, he said, I got it right over the head. He says, no, he says, I ain't too old. He says, I want to join the communists. So that was how he was converted. Then an incident there at the Honeywell strike. You know, there was when the pattern makers, they went out and they pulled the rest of them with them. And they closed the plant down, or originally closed it down, but when the shift, change of shift came, they came off in the morning. When the afternoon shift went on, well, they had to practically close down. But in the meantime, the company had organized back to work movements, see, and they had their loyal employees, you know, who were anti-union. And started out first, they were across the street, the lawyer employees, and they would try to shove their way through the picket lines. And there were a couple of dozen that were the key men leaders in it, you know, see, and they try to lead the movement back to work, you know, see, and get the rest of them to follow, see. Well, along the picket line, we had scrimmagers. There was myself and Howard Fortier and Kluka and a number of others. So of course, when the leaders would come after we know who they were, why, we'd meet them head on before they even hit the picket line and try to hang a haymaker on. Well, I didn't know Howard Fortier at the time too well. And I was on one of these movements when they were trying to break the picket line. Howard Fortier got mixed up in with the loyal employees. And after I hit the one, I swung around and called the haymaker and I hung the haymaker on his jaw. See? Well, I was kind of pretty sorry about that for a long time. Now I'm sorry I didn't follow it up and give him a couple more. The way he turned
out. How did he get mixed up with you were saying something about Mayville giving you
Later on, they organized the women, and police was there, and there would be 30, 40 police that surround about 15, 20 women, and they'd take them in through the picket line. And it was difficult, you know, for the men, they could break through the police occasionally, but it wasn't very good strategy for the men to rough up these women going back to work. Mm-hmm. So after they got a number of groups through there, after having a few councils, and Mr. Leonard Lagman and a few others, myself, we hit upon the idea that some of the loyal union women should get over there with them and handle that situation, which, of course, soon was put into practice. When the next group came through, two women that seemed to be the leader of this bunch, suddenly, as they got out in the middle of the street, found one union member on grabbing their right arm, the other the left, another one grabbing the dress behind them, another one in front, and it was just a matter of she's standing in her panties and brassieres. Well, that happened to two of them just quick. Well, of course, the police, they started to laugh, and it kind of struck them funny. And last we see them, these two women were headed down 4th Avenue towards Lake Street. See? Well, that broke that. In the meantime, Harry Mayville, see, when they come back over across on the vacant lot, Harry Mayville, he was up there in a car and started to explain the union movement to them and so on and so forth. And after about 20 minutes talk to him, he'd come back and he led about two-thirds of the back-to-work movement back with him into the picket line. That was the end of the strike. The next morning, they got to an agreement and went back to work. See, that's how quickly that was set up. See, now Mayville, he was one of these, you know Mayville at all. He's a worker's background. He talked to the workers in their own language and explained to them from their own problems. And someone out of a speaker like that is much more effective on a picket line and in mass work when the workers are active than it is an intellectual who goes into a lot of highbrow explanation and so on. They want to know about their day-to-day problem, their food, their shelter, their crews, and how to fix them in that respect. And that was, of course, the line that Mabel was very good in explaining to them.
Did these
people
come from the old country, or were they...
Glenn Roberts. And what's his name now? His father was a streetcar worker.
Figueroa?
What?
Figueroa?
Yeah, Figueroa. Uh-huh. Yeah. You see that they didn't push them into positions of leadership. But you see, they all had working class backgrounds, were grounded in the workers' movement, and, you know, were a very heart and soul of the workers themselves. Mm-hmm. Instead, they pushed into the lead certain people with a higher education and an intellectual background, and they just weren't capable of handling it.
Well,
in
any way,
beautiful old fellow
guy. I've known in the party at that time, and had been, for quite a while. And what we needed was more intellectuals, and push them into the leadership, and give them the key positions.
Like who?
First open incident that's traceable was when they moved the bookstore out of the working class district and try to put it up
and cater to
the intellectuals.
Who became leaders here who were intellectuals? I mean, locally, outside of the people who came from the East.
Well,
I mean, Bob Kelly's not an intellectual.
No, but like
being progressive, where did they get this?
You don't know, huh?
No, and I thought that I'd
live with the workers and work with them and live on the income that the worker live on for a part of the time each year. Mm-hmm. That's very important.
Well,
that's very important.
Intellectuals too have to do that.
See? What?
Intellectuals,
we'll
or writers, or artists, yeah. they have to do that.
We'll never have a successful party until something like that is put into operation.
Yeah. You see, in China, for instance, they took intellectuals to leadership.
What?
In China. They had intellectuals in leadership.
The intellectuals are needed. That is what I'm finding.
But they should be connected.
What?
They have to be connected with the people.
That's right.
So that's why they send elections back to the farm.
An intellectual who does not work with the people and live with them and has the same problems that they do, he has no experience of his own.
Yes.
And he very soon, you know, after over a period of years, drops into the point of view where he is incapable of taking that experience secondhand directly from the workers. In other words, he begins to develop a sort of a disdainful contempt towards the workers' criticism and advice.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen that. We went through all of that here.
I think that's working through now more than ever. I think that's going to come out.
What?
I think that's coming out more now than ever.
Well, after all, you see now, they've practically lost their base amongst the workers.
But you see, we got a lot of help.
Well, it's got to be reestablished.
So we got a lot of help doing that too. We mustn't forget the hysteria of the FBI and everything.
Well, sure, we know all the problems. There's a lot of them.
During this year of hysteria, I don't know how many of that trip was a year ago, but I was out there. One after the other, they didn't even dare talk to me because they looked behind me.
I'm not exaggerating when I say the last 5.5 to 6 years, I've averaged at least 6 visits to the FBI, or attempted visits, rather, mostly what they turned out to be, a year. Now, the last one, was a little over a month ago.
Really?
Yeah.
I hear they're busy again now.
Oh, yeah.
A sweet, mild-mannered
servant,
John. He used to...
He looked like
Michael. He even looked like him.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the the DFL congressional candidate wouldn't have made near the showing that he did.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the Kefauver people in the DFL that would rather not vote at all than vote for an out-and-out machine candidate.
Mm-hmm.
See, we find that over in the 12th Ward Club, you know, see, there's quite a base there, you know, of the Kefauver people, see. It's enough there to the extent that Weifkus is a delegate to the county convention, see, and an alternate to the state convention. See, that's put over by the Kefauver people, see, because her and I had both spoken out. I didn't attend, see, because I was working nights, so I was out, see. But they put her in, you see, as a protest movement against them, see.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
See, it was quite openly spoken. Well, here's one more incident that I call it. That's in the Miller cafeteria strike. You're familiar with that, see. They had organized a movement there of the petty bourgeois women go down there and take their lunch down there, you see, to help finance the resistance of Miller's, see. Well, they would, of course, pay no attention to picket lines and walk right on through and make all kinds of sneering, condescending remarks to the pickets as they went in and out, see. And it took a week or more before we finally found a solution to that. When we found it, it was really quite simple. Took up a little collection, got a few dollars, and went down on Washington Avenue and picked up the the dehorn stiffs, the most demoralized element on Washington Avenue, see, who had their dirty and filthy and bugs and lice running around on their coat collars, see, and give them each a nickel to buy a cup of coffee and set one at a table all over the cafeteria. And when these women come in, they couldn't find a place to sit down, except they had to sit down at a table with one of these men there. And that was just too much for their petty snobbishness. They just couldn't take it. Most of them just walked in and set their trays down on the table and then walked out again. Didn't even eat. And that, the third day, why, there wasn't many there. The workers had all sorts of confidence in him. Now, when they had a grievance to settle in 665, they could get Swan, why, that they were happy. But they never did like Ray Wright. And, of course, Kelly, at that time, he wasn't considered as Swan's equal at that. But then after Swan died, well, then, and Kelly got more of the grievance to handle, and he developed more, and they began to get a lot of confidence in him. Mm-hmm. But Wrighty, they never did have any confidence in him to being able to, you know, see, they... They always figured that Ray Wrighty was the kind of a man that, well, he would go along with the boss. But they never had that feeling about Swan Esser. They know when he went in there, he was strictly their man. And he would, well, like one worker says, he says it was necessary, he says, to open the negotiations, he'll spit in the boss's eye to get him to talk along the problems that we're there for.
Well, he was very...
Only figure how. Mm-hmm. Now, although Ole never held a union position, you know, that it paid him any salary. And between them two, they done a lot of good work. Mm-hmm. I think if it wouldn't have been for those two, then their 665 would have went under.
I think so. Well, they originated it, didn't they? I mean, they really organized it.
That's right. Now, see, like, wife, Emily, you know, she organized the YMCA there, you know, see, and of course, mostly that was under Ole Fagerhaus, you know, she was just new, you know, she, and during that period, she joined the party, you know, while that was going on, but she had no previous direct contact with the party at all, see, and she got in there, and I think she was getting $45 a month, see, as a cook. When she just got too much for her, she went down to see the union, and happened that she got to talk to Ole Fagerhaus in there. And then they began planning and working, and she organized it from the inside, see.
My dad would post them on certain corners, certain trees, on certain roads.
I wasn't quite sure about why they started digging into the classics until they found something that would give them the key to the answer.
Well, one thing about Swan, too, he was an educator. I mean, he really developed people.
That's right. Well, that was...
I knew him, you know, he started his school down here.
That was also true of Ole Fagerhaus. You know, them two worked together a good deal. Mm-hmm. And when I participated and listened to many of their meetings, you know, and for a while I was educating the people when we were trying to organize serial open mail order workers, you know, and there were mostly women working at the mail order department there, you know.
Oh, you were in that too?
Well, yeah, I was teaching trade union class for about a year or that, you know, once every week, you know, to two different groups, see, so I had two meetings a week with them, see, and of course, there was only a few that had any knowledge of Marxism at all when it started with, but when they got through, they knew a lot more about Marxism than they did before. Because they never tried to make an explanation or point out a certain procedure they could take without going into the class struggle and analyzing it for them and giving them some idea about Marxism. And usually, see, when they come in there, well, they come in with their problems. See, we had no set class, you know, that is no set study. Except they'd come in with their problems that had happened to them in the past week, see, and then we would thrash out what...
Was this after the union was established?
Well, that's when they were trying to establish it.
When the longshoremen came in to organize them?
No, that was the... at that time was the... wait a minute. The clerical workers, wasn't it? That wasn't it either, was the...
But first I knew
it was the white-collar union.
The longshoremen came in.
Well, they came in later.
To organize...
They came in later.
Later,
yeah. You see, we didn't get it organized. You know, this country spy system was too darn good. Mm-hmm. And here was an incident in the mill that just happened to recall it. See, I didn't participate in that, but I had many talks with the men that were very active in it, see, and it took them several years to get that because of the spy system they had in there. And the way I gathered it, The way it happened, they started trying to organize it from the inside, and of course the country or the company spies would report any union activity, and immediately the workers get fired. See, that went on for a number of years. See, but in the meantime, of course, the union men also learned a few tricks, and they began to get their company spies and stool pigeons pretty well spotted and pegged. See, and as they began to get them spotted and pegged, well, of course, they had less and less to report to the company, and the union was getting more members, and the company, of course, and one reason their stool pigeons, they don't trust their stool pigeons too much either, you know. They have spies watching their spies. So, well, it came about that some of the company stool pigeons came to the union men and pretended to be union workers, you know. She wanted to join unions. And, of course, when the union men knew who they were, they set a nice trap for them. Took several months to do it, but the way they set the trap and sprung it was like this. They got them to subscribe to the worker and daily worker, and that time they called it the Communist at the monthly magazine, and then they had a meeting down here. I forget now who is one of the national committee men came down here at a meeting, although it was a public meeting. And, of course, they invited a number of these stool pigeons to attend. See, that's where they would get their information, see. And they'd find out who the communists were in their union, see. That's the way the company stool pigeons operated, see. But there was also spies watching these company stool pigeons. The day after the meeting, there were 9 of them fired. Of their own stool pigeons, see.
You mean they exposed them as subscribers to the workers?
The company had their own spies. No, see, these company stool pigeons subscribed to communist literature and started 10 communist meetings, see. Mm-hmm. Well, then they had men watching. The company had men watching their stool pigeons and spies, see.
Oh.
They had a double set of spies, see. One that was set that would spy right on the workers themselves. The other set that would spy upon the spies, see. And that's these that were spying upon the workers were the ones that got it. You see, that's the way the union members and a few party members in there set the trap for them.
Oh.
See? You see, it took a long while before they got, you know, figure out the know-how and just see how the ground, how everything was set up in there. See? But when they had that, see, then they began set this trap for them, see, and that got a lot of their company fired some of their own spies. And about 2 months later, well, they had a strike, see, and that's when they got their first union contract. But that played quite a part.
Choral group. And some of the most beautiful songs, really, that are done up to choral work that I have ever heard. I think it's...
What is now the CLU?
Mm-hmm.
I think he was secretary. And I know in attending some of the committee meetings, you know, the way they would load Jimmy down with work, it was just terrible, you know. He just couldn't. It's impossible for one man to do all that. See? And he finally, after a year or two, he just told in the sponge. He just couldn't keep it up.
And they broke up his family.
Yeah.
His wife lives in California, you know. He had 5 children.
Yeah. You see, they should have given him, you know, a reasonable amount of work. Why load the whole thing? Everything that had to be descended is always Jimmy. Every time we met, they'd have 2, 3, 4 resolutions that Jimmy was supposed to introduce and lay the groundwork for him, get up petitions in the mm-hmm. in the building trades, and there was all sorts of people that were at least 15.
I saw it in the paper, newspaper, not too long ago again. Like some greetings or something. So I know that
she set up all the party members who, that were in the hotel and restaurant workers. That is in 665 and. And what is 558? The cooks and waiters. They all met in one unit in the party, see, you know, in one branch.
Yeah.
Well, of course, a policy in the party then was browbeerism, the strong browbeerism. Well, at one time, just before the war broke out, before the wages had been froze, I'll give you an indication of what happened, of how things go. And this wasn't the first time something like this happened. It was quite a regular procedure. We would agree in the branch What about what our policy should be in these two unions, see? As to wages and working conditions and so on, see? And we'd start working like that amongst our fellow workers on the job, see, and explaining to them. And a week or two later, we find Kelly and Lighty having a different program that they were implementing. But like this one case, this is the way that went. See, you know, I don't blame Kelly, but... this was, like I said, before the wages had been froze. And it was going to set up and prepare for a strike in case it was necessary to back up the negotiating committee. So everything had been, we could get the approval of the CLU. They was going to support it. And the next was the International. So we strike funds. Well, that was up to Kelly. He was supposed to take that arrangement and write to the International and get that taken care of. And it's coming down to where we had only a matter of weeks in which to do it anymore. But the convention of the hotel and restaurant workers was also coming up very shortly after. Well, at the next meeting of the branch, we found that Kelly had not even wrote the letter to the International. And when we put him on the pan as to what his reasons was, well, he said that it was party policy. They had decided that it was better for him not to stick his neck out and ask for more money for the workers in the hotel and restaurant board. Because that would antagonize Kilday. And he needed Kilday's support to get elected district organizer at the convention of the International. And that would be more important than getting the workers better working conditions and more money. Now that was the way Browderism operated in the trade unions in that instance. Mm-hmm. And we had instances very similar.
And at the same time, it was so pathetic.
I think all those letters we got during the 50s from about in the worker, we got the same thing.
We started to read Marx and Engels and Lenin, and we couldn't, somehow we couldn't just find the answer. Well, we had only some of the special works of Lenin at the time, but then we decided we'd get Lenin's selected works, 12 volumes. Well, I went to the bookstore, and this girl named Julia, she was in the bookstore at that time, I forget what her last name was.
Yeah, Julia.
Yeah. She said they didn't have them. And I asked if she could order them for me. Well, she said, you better go to the party office and see. Well, I had a talk with Eric Burke. Yeah, Lennon was obsolete. No longer the thing to read. The reason said it by
Lennon was obsolete?
That's right.
So then I
tried to send for these books to New York bookstore. I had several bookstores at that time. I tried two of them. Each time the money came back. Then I tried to ordering them under the name of Donald Pearson. But given the same address. That letter didn't come back to me, but that came back to the client. And I was called on the Carver place for Carl Winters. I told Richie the same thing. Reading of Lennon was obsolete. It was disloyal to the party.
Oh. Say, here where each individual family goes its own way. Unless you're probably in some real close-knit church group or something. But,
well, the party virtually was taking as a guide the steps that the Soviet Union took when they turned into socialists. Well, the difference was in the Soviet Union when they established socialism there, it was between 80% and 90% of the people were living on farms, and there had to be steps taken to get them develop industry and get these workers into industry. Well, one of the things necessary is, under a procedure like that, is to make it attractive, more attractive for them in industry than it would be on the farms. In other words, that they would want to go into industry. Well, so the same steps were taken here in this country where better than 80% of the people already were non-farmers. And around 16% were producing working on the farms, producing all the farm products. Yet the party's policy was that the farmers were entitled to much less income, much poorer working conditions, much poorer standard of living than the people in industry. That was the party policy. They didn't put it in those words, but that was the actual facts, the way it went.
The party wasn't responsible for the farm conditions.
They are not responsible for them, but they didn't have a program that would give any answer to them. They haven't yet. Maybe it couldn't be given. Farmers being pulled out very, very rapidly. That's the farmer that's producing the butter, the milk, the eggs, and mainly the pork, but to a much lesser extent the beef, but to still a considerable extent.
The small farmers?
What?
The
smaller farms, yes. The bigger farms specialize. Beets, cotton, potatoes, wheat, grain, what? Soybeans.
Do you think a small farmer can be defended?
Well, but you see, if they take all the small farmers away, there's going to be a great shortage in some of the foods. If they would just immediately take all the small farmers away, there's got to be a certain program to meet this transition. Whether we like it or not, we're going into big scale farming under capitalism here.
What program would you propose?
We're not going to stop it. Well, you've got to have a program for these people so they can live like human beings while that transition is taking place.
I know, but what program will you propose to make that possible?
Well, getting back to this parity formula. Like I said, parity, if you take it at face value, sounds good. Because if you look it up in the dictionary, it means equality. Let's say parity of 90% or 80 or 90 or 100% of parity. Well, you would naturally take it as taking it at face value. That the farmers then, if they get 90% of parity, would get 90% the income that the average workers would elsewhere. But that isn't the case. They got a little gimmick in there. That gimmick is this. When they say parity, they mean the definition of parity as it's implemented by our Department of Agriculture and our national policy is that the farmers should get parity, 90 or 80 or 90 or 100% of parity what they got in 1909 to 1914. Now, if we're progressive, how in the name of common sense are we going to get up there in a meeting and tell these farmers what you want is 80 or 90 or 100% as much as you had in 1909 to 1914?
And what are you going to tell them?
Well, they should have parity of a certain percent of parity with the other groups and segments of the economy now. That's the sort of policy we should try to work for.
With labor, you mean?
Yes. After all, the farmer works just as hard and requires just as much skill as any skilled worker in industry. As a matter of fact, in industry you earn one skill. As a farmer, you've got to have many skills.
Well, how can this be worked out to give him that?
What?
How can it be worked out to give him that?
I didn't know.
How can it be worked out to give him?
Well, we can't get it for it, but we've got to explain these basic facts to the farmer so they know what they're up against.
In the meantime, how are we going to defend the small farmer, protect him? I mean, how are we going to fight for him?
Well,
we can fight for the small farm, especially, but...
How do you fight for anyone in a changing economy? Economy that's passing from one method of production into another. And the main thing, we try to make it possible for these people to transfer from one means of production into another with the least amount of suffering, don't we?
But they can't go into industry now.
And that attitude and that thing was never taken towards the farmers.
Well, they can't go into industry now. Unemployment is starting in industry. What are they going to do? They got to get relief or something.
Well, the workers have got
26 weeks of unemployment insurance. How much insurance has the farmers got? None. That's one thing we could get.
Unemployment insurance for the farmers?
Why, certainly. Why shouldn't they have? The difference is with between a worker and a farmer. A farmer, he starts out at the beginning of the year and he has to work all year before he gets his income. He doesn't know what he's going to get. At the end of the year, he may have to even pay for the privilege of working. Mm-hmm. And he can collect no unemployment insurance. There should be some guarantee payment. Like crop insurance in case of drought and hail and things like that. There's an adequate coverage. A set price.
Well, that's an old program. I mean, that's what we advocate.
In other words, we all heard more or less about the Branham Plan. We should that could be a beginning of working out a foreign policy with considerable adhesions. And it should be done. Now, the Branham Plan had one point that it limited the payment to the smaller farmers who are in a period of transition. That is a very good feature.
See, that's an old demand.
That plan, that Branham plan, was junk.
Yeah, but that what you said about this guarantee payment of the farmers in case the crop failure. So that's an old plan. That's been advocated and proposed long, long time ago. By even the party did that.
But who abandoned it?
The party proposed it too.
Yeah, but who abandoned it? Who abandoned any programs for the farmers?
Who did?
Well, the Democratic Party was the only one that had any program, and the Communist Party just yes, the Democratic program.
You're wrong.
Sure, there was some little variations, but not a great deal.
I think that's
the wrong attitude. Well, after all, the party program was, they'd come out, you could read the party press, they'd advocate maybe a slightly high degree, percentage of parity than the Democratic Party, but that was the only difference.
No,
that was
a big difference.
That's the only difference I could ever find. And the only difference that anyone had ever explained to me that when I'd asked, and I wrote more than in contact with a great many men in the farmers. So.
Continuation of the WPA, and that the city council members should be present at the auditorium to hear from the workers.
Are multiplied accordingly? It can't mean anything else.
Yes. That's right. We're in the most difficult position here.
That's right. You see, we're today setting in the same position that the German people were under the Reich of Hitler.
Yeah, that's a lot of problems.
What?
6:30.
You know, look, a good indication is my, what it does to people. My brother, he never was what you'd call a left winger. But he was quite active in the Farmer Labor Party, see, and he had some understanding of what was taking place, but not too much. Well, when the war started, he started out on these defense jobs, and he continued. He worked at it for many years until about 4 years ago, then he started, then them jobs were all done. There were no more jobs for him in the defense work. And he started working for a company here, but he's been deteriorating rather than all these. He's got a complete nervous breakdown. He knew what he was doing and said he was a hatchet man for the big American capitalists that were invading every country in the world. I was down to see him. He's from Freeze Falls. Now, see, he isn't too bad, you know, but just at times he kind of loses, forgets about it. He can't remember nothing. And then at times he's quite rational for days at a stretch.
Yeah.
Okay. And he's got some idea now with the treating psychiatrist what caused his breakdown. He says, he worked in a number of these Spanish countries. He worked in Portugal, right off the coast of Portugal on an island there where they put on a big base. He's been in Guatemala, Venezuela, and the Spanish-speaking people, see. And, that island off the coast of Portugal was part of Spain, see, so there were Spanish-speaking people there. He said, you know, he said, they referred to all of us Americans as white pigs, gringos. And he says, you know, he says, working when seeing what we were doing to these Spanish countries, he says, certainly, he says, they had every justification to call us white pigs, because he says, I had never seen pigs act so hoggish and so selfish and mistreat their own kind the way we do the Spanish people. And he says the Spanish people, he says, are the most polite and the best mannered people he ever met. But he says, you can't say that about America.
No, I guess that's true.
And of course, you know, see, when they went out, he was in Guatemala, you know, when they overthrew the government.
Yeah.
And the way that came about, he went down, signed up for the job to go there. He had been paid from the day he left here. He got down there and they confined him to a barracks for 2 months. Paying him from $500 to $800 a month. He's American. Until they could get that government overthrown. The moment that government was overthrown, he said, it must work. Times, he says, within a matter of hours, after the rebels took over, you know, the fascists, you know, he says, sign an agreement to give the American, that was the Standard Oil Company, you see, and give them the rights to the oil and the hydroelectric power plant. I mean, he was working on a power plant. He said, everything shipped in, see, ready for this. There's all this planned months ahead. Only thing is, their timetable missed a little bit, see? That had delayed them several months more longer than they had anticipated. And he says, the Guatemalan people, he says, the workers, he says, knew, he says, no, never no doubt about it, what the Americans were doing. See, and that government they overthrew was the first legally elected government, democratically, elected government that ever had in Guatemala. And it's kind of like the United Front. It had all anti-imperialist factions in it, see, including a minority of whom were the communists.
Well, we got our problems here, but yes, we're busy now with this book.
What?
See, we're busy now with this book we're putting out.
Yeah, well, that's what I was getting at. I was going to pay for 5 books in advance.
Oh, I get the mirror seat. I got her. Yeah, I'll be right back.
Yeah. See, what date is today?
18. Excuse me,
the
damn telephone, I just hear it.
Always waiting. Find the defendant in this criminal case because he left as a result of it.
You mean he walked out?
Walked out. And they never did find him again.
I never heard of that.
Yeah. And then they of course, brought in the fire department and began to wrench the people there, but the hoses were cut, and so that proved ineffective. And after battling for sometime on the outside why the demonstration finally dispersed. Now, this was on April the 6th. And then, following April 6th, there was a call for a May Day demonstration. And one of the big demands in that May Day demonstration were for the release of those who had been arrested. And in that connection, the newspapers and the